You want to discuss maybe a few relatively shorter inyanim from the Seder instead of one major thing that will take up the whole time. We start with something from the end, toward the end of the Seder. Torah says this twice in the Torah. Reishis bikurei admoshva tovi beis Hashem alokecha lo savashal gedi bechalev imo. The Torah puts together the mitzvah of bringing bikurim. Reishis bikurei admoshva tovi beis Hashem alokecha, that the first fruits have to be brought to the Beis HaMikdash. And it puts it right next in the same sentence with lo savashal gedi bechalev imo, the prohibition of basar b'cholav, of cooking milk and meat together, and eating or having any enjoyment from the product. The bishul is osur, the eating is osur, and having hanoah from it, having enjoyment, benefit from it is osur. The obvious question is, why do these two things go together? So some say, since one of the Rishonim says even, that they used to use a mixture of milk and meat together as a fertilizer to make fruit grow better. So in that respect, you can understand. The Torah said that to bring your first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash, but don't induce them to grow better so you'll have nice, fatter fruit to bring to God by cooking milk and meat and using it for fertilizer. That's one idea. The Rambam seems to say that there was an idolatrous rite that they did somehow by cooking milk and meat together when they brought their first fruits, and therefore the Torah prohibits it because of this idolatrous rite. I was thinking of a different idea, and that's the following. First of all, you have to understand why the Torah demands the reishis, the firsts, right? Firsts are not only always best. I mean, I'm a firstborn. I have no trouble believing that the first is best. But my brothers, Aleihem HaShalom, may not have agreed with that. And the truth is that the first is not necessarily always the best. Sometimes the second one's the best. Third one's the best. So why didn't the Torah say, bring me some samples, get some samples, first, second, third, and bring me the best? Why the first? There are many answers. But one answer, I think, is that the first sets the pattern and the foundation and the root for everything that comes after. And therefore it sets the pattern. Whatever you do after that first is built on the foundation of the first, and on the, it emanates from the root that the first represents, and therefore it follows that pattern. So if you dedicate the first wholly to God, then everything that will follow at least will be minimally holy. You set the pattern, you set the foundation. And that's why the root and the foundation of something always has to be stronger than the thing itself. If the root has even a small blemish, it's going to come out 1,000 times in the plant. But if you have that same blemish on a leaf, it's not going to cause any problem. If you have a hairline crack in the foundation of a building, it endangers the entire building. But that same hairline crack on the third floor is not going to cause too many problems. So the foundation and the root have to be more perfect, and therefore we dedicate them wholly to God, and then whatever follows suit, whatever emanates from that root and that foundation is built on a strong foundation and a healthy root. That's the concept of reishis. And therefore the Torah demands all the reishis, all the beginnings, beginning of the year, beginning of the shearings of the wool, the first fruits, firstborn, animals, human beings, so on. Okay. So that means that you're taking the first and you're dedicating it to the Ribbono Shel Olam in order that what comes from it, that which emanates after the first, will be built on a firm understanding that everything has to be dedicated to God. Okay. Now let's go to milk and meat. The Torah says it in a way, even though it's not limited to that specific case, but the Torah says it, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. The milk represents the mother, and the first food that the animal eats in giving it its existence in this world. And the meat represents the, what's it called, the, what comes from that milk, what grows, right? Now, if you cook milk and meat together, you're taking the rachis, the beginning of the animal's life, and you're combining it with the end of the animal's life, meaning the dead flesh, the meat, and you're doing it for your own enjoyment. That's taking the opposite of what the rachis is. Normally, we take the beginning and we dedicate it to God, so that the whole purpose is holiness, dedication to God in everything that we do. But here you're taking the beginning, the first, you are cooking it together with the final to make a closed system where the first and the last only serve your personal needs, your own personal enjoyment. Right? That's the exact antithesis of the mitzvah of reishis. So reishis bikurad masa tovis Hashem lokecha. And don't do the antithesis of that, which is lo savashu gedi b'chalevimo. Therefore, there's a connection between the two. Okay, let's go back to the beginning of the Sedra. The beginning of the Sedra, following the giving of the Torah, so the Torah now gave the Mishpatim. Mishpatim are more or less civil law, rational laws. And it says in the Pasuk that lo magid devarav liyakov chukov u'mishpatov liyisrael, the Rabban Shalom said his words to Yaakov, his chukim and his mishpatim liyisrael, lo osachein l'chol goy, he didn't do that to all nations, u'mishpatim bal yedom haleluka, and he didn't make known to them his mishpatim. Now l'chora, that this pasuk applies to Matan Torah. Magid Devarav Yaakov means that God said his words to the Jewish people directly. Chukov u'mishpatov, in the Aseres HaDibros there were chukim and there was mishpatim. The first five were between man and God, pretty much chukim, and the last five between man and man were mishpatim. And he didn't do that to all the nations. He didn't give them the Torah. He didn't reveal his Torah to them on Har Sinai. U'mishpatim, and he didn't teach them, he didn't make known to them his mishpatim. So the question is, I would understand if it said he didn't make known to the nations of the world his chukim. But mishpatim is civil, rational laws. The goyim have civil, rational laws, just as much as we do. What they don't have is the chukim that we have. Basar b'cholav they don't have. They don't have things that are paraduma. Those things that are super rational, they don't have. But rational things, don't murder, don't steal, things that are rational, they do have. So why could the Pasuk say, U'mishpatim bal yedom? God didn't make known his mishpatim to the nations of the world. If anything, that's the part that they do have. The answer is that even though mishpatim are civil law, and to a certain degree they have a rational basis, but they are also super rational. Every mishpat is really a chok in its essence. And every chok has some rational reasons behind it, even though in essence it's a chok. So there's no real difference between chukim and mishpatim except in degree. Chukim, the most part, is beyond rationale, even though there are some ideas, rational ideas. And mishpatim, there's a vast area where it makes sense and there's rationale, even though essentially, right, it's chukim. Give me an example. The murder. Okay, murder in its black and white areas, right, going and shooting somebody through the brains, right, for no good reason, or even for a good reason, is rational. If everybody would go around killing people they don't like, there wouldn't be too many people left in this world. So it's wrong to, what's it called, to take human life. For rational, it makes sense. But that's in the black and white areas. How about the gray areas? Euthanasia, right? Not young people in Asia, but mercy killing, right? Mercy killing. Give you the following scenario. Somebody is 119 and a half years old. He doesn't have any teeth, can't barely see, can't barely hear, right? He's on his last leg, to say the least. And he's really, really suffering. He has some kind of fatal disease that is in terrible pain. And he says to you, do me a favor, put me out of my misery. Give me an overdose of morphine and kill me. Would you say that, rationally speaking, it would be irrational to kill him? I wouldn't want to argue somebody on a rational basis to prohibit that. It makes a lot of sense to me rationally that the guy is asking to be killed. His life is pretty much at the lowest level of quality, and he wants to be killed, so do him a favor. Put him out of his misery. Yet, the Torah says, if you do that, you are liable to the death penalty. It's murder. No shaila. It's murder. Okay? Or how about abortion? Right? The woman is pregnant. She didn't want to get pregnant. She was raped. It's in the early stages of the pregnancy, and she wants to have an abortion. I wouldn't want to argue against someone who was pro-abortion on a rational, purely rational basis, because I could think of a very fine, strong, rational case to permit abortion, at least at some stages. It's a woman's right. She was forced into this. It's not really a viable life. A million things that, except it's osur because the Torah said it's osur. Where it's osur. It's not always osur, but when the Torah says it's prohibited, it's prohibited. It's not rational. It's super rational. It's beyond rational. So even though the Mishpatim are basically rational laws, that's only in their black and white areas. But in the gray areas, they are not rational necessarily. So every Mishpat is also a chok. That's why when the nations of the world were offered the Torah, God said to them, they asked God, what's in it? God said, it says you can't murder. They said, we have a problem because we have a blessing that we live by the sword. How can we have a Torah that doesn't say, that says you can't murder? So the Rebbe Shem left them. He went to Yishmael. They said, he told them, it says you can't steal. They said, we have a bracha that says our hands in everybody's pocket and their hands in our pocket. So how can we have a Torah that says you can't steal? Everybody asks, those mitzvahs anyway they had to keep. Those are Sheva Mitzvah Noach. They're from the seven mitzvahs of Noach, not stealing and not murdering. What did they gain by not receiving the Torah? If God would have said them, it says in the Torah, don't eat basar b'chalav, we like cheeseburgers. You know, we can't get used to not eating cheeseburgers. I understand that. You don't accept the Torah, you don't have to eat, you don't have to stay away from cheeseburgers. But murder, stealing, that's part of the seven mitzvahs. What did they gain? The answer, I think, according to this is, that if they had the seven mitzvahs of Noach, those were given over to the rationale of human beings. So we're willing not to murder rationally. We're willing not to steal rationally. But once it's the Torah that's giving it part of the 613 mitzvahs, it's no longer on the rational level. Now it's a different realm. It's beyond rationale. That we're not interested in. So every mishpat has in it an aspect of what's it called, of a chok, and every chok has an aspect of mishpat, which translated in a different, another way is, every civil law that's between man and man also has within it a component that's between man and God. And every mitzvah between man and God affects human beings too, and has a implication for between man and man, that you can't separate those two realms. In fact, that's why the Mishpatim came right after Matan Torah. Because one would think from the Torah being given that it's, you know, highfalutin, very, high ideas. But it's not. Something has to filter into everyday life. Because if it doesn't, it's not the Torah. That's why the angels didn't get the Torah. It has to be something that applies to everyday mundane affairs, brings the Torah into the mundane world also. But that same mundane world is infused with holiness. And the holy worlds are infused with between man and man too. Let me give you some examples from the Sedra. Where what seems to be a civil, rational, between man and man law has implications between man and God. And the opposite is also true. Let's start with the following. Mitzvah of the nezek of Dalad Vehei. Dalad Vehei is the following. If a person steals a sheep and he slaughters it or sells it, he has to pay back four times the value of the sheep that he stole. If he steals a ox and he sells it or slaughters it, he has to pay back five times. So the simple rational idea is this is a fine because you didn't just steal the guy's sheep or his ox, you stole his potential working ability, because most people used sheep and oxen for plowing, for meat, for what's it called, for shearing, for its wool. It has a value beyond its body. So I didn't only deprive the person of the value of the sheep and the ox, I deprived him of the work he could have done with it or whatever, and therefore, since I'm depriving a person of his livelihood, of his basic necessities, I have to pay a fine. And the fine is four, five times, whatever. But there are aspects over here that are beyond rationale. For instance, one of the Mepharshim, the Gemara says, one of the ideas behind paying four or five, why four for a sheep and five for an ox? Why not five for both or four for both? What's the difference between the four times and the five times between the sheep and the ox? So the Gemara says like this, that when you steal an ox, you lead it through the streets on a leash. And there's no embarrassment in doing that because nobody knows it's not yours. But when you steal a sheep, you don't lead it through the street on a leash, you carry it. And carrying a sheep publicly is an embarrassment. So the guy who stole the sheep embarrassed himself by having to carry it. He already has paid back one time through the embarrassment. So he only has to pay four. But the ox has the full five. Now, on the surface, it doesn't make any sense. Because who are you paying to? You're paying to the person you stole it from. What does in the world does he care if I got embarrassed or not? The embarrassment may mitigate my responsibility to be fined, right, to be punished. But what is the other guy to gain? He gets the four times or five times because I was embarrassed, therefore he gets one time less. The idea being that even though this is a civil law and it's a matter of payment for depriving somebody of his thing, stealing it, it's a fine, but there's an aspect over here of bein adam lemakom to bein adam liatzmo of migos. And if I was embarrassed, then I got part of my punishment. And therefore, you don't have to mean out to me five times, just four times is enough. So there's a portion of this which is beyond rationale that has nothing to do between man and man, but it has more between man and himself, of what kind of person you are. In addition, it even goes beyond that. It says in Parshas Kisisa, that after the sin of the golden calf, about 3,000 people fell in a plague that came to punish the people who served the eagle. The Torah says, "Vayehi amesim b'magefa kishloshes alfei ish." It was approximately about 3,000 people. That's kishloshes alfei ish. Says the Vilna Gaon, that doesn't make sense. How many people actually served the golden calf that had to die in this plague? So the Medrash says on the pasuk in Shir HaShirim in Kohelis, Achas me elef matzasi, the isha achas me elo matzasi. The pasuk says, I found 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 of men, and no women. So the Medrash says this pasuk is referring to the sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf, 1 out of every 1,000 Jews sinned, and no women sinned. Now, if you figure out, if 1 out of every 1,000 sinned, and there were 600,000 Jews between 20 and 60, so 1 out of 1,000 sinned, how many sinned? 600. So why did 3,000 die? Says the Vilna Gaon, the sin of the golden calf, in one perspective, was the following. The Jews panicked. They thought that Moshe Rabbeinu was no longer with them. He died. He went to Shamayim. He's no longer coming back. He's not going to come back for us. And we're in the middle of the desert. And we need to channel God's direction to us, God's goodness to us, God's influence on us through a receiving station. That receiving station used to be Moshe. Moshe was the one who received God's influence and broadcast it to us. But like a radio station, you need a receiver to receive, and then it filters down to your personal, radios. So they felt that Moshe Rabbeinu was like an intermediary. He was like the one who received the influence from God, and then he broadcast it to the Jewish people. But now Moshe's not here anymore. We need something to take his place. And a human being will just have the same problem. He may disappear too. We want something more, concrete. Something more lasting. So they said gold lasts pretty long, so let's make a golden ox. And that ox will be the physical manifestation of the spiritual power that God brings into the world of giving plenty influence of food in the desert. Why? Because God, the powers, the spiritual powers that God created with which to deal with the world is represented partially by his Merkava, his chariot. And around the chariot are four figures that represent four spiritual powers. One is the ox, the other is a lion, the other is a eagle, and then the face of a human being. Those are the four spiritual powers that are represented by these images that through which God influences the world. The influence for parnasa, for livelihood, for sustenance, comes from the shore, the ox. So what did the Jewish people do? They knew how to harness the power of that ox and use it to direct God's bounty into the world. That's why they wanted to build an eagle and manipulate it to be the receiving station, right, of God's bounty in the desert of livelihood. Like a shore, ocheleisov, like an ox eating grass. The ox represents plowing, planting, harvesting. That's the ox. So the ox is what they needed in the desert. So basically what they did is they stole the power, that spiritual power of the ox, and used it for their own personal purposes. So, when you steal an ox, how much do you have to pay back? 5 times. Yeah? So, if 600 people actually sinned, right, according to halacha, you'd have to have 5 times as much, which is 3,000. So the pasuk says that the 600 were considered like 3,000. Kish, loshes, they weren't 3,000, but they were like 3,000, because when it comes to stealing an ox and making restitution, you have to make restitution 5 times as much. So the 600 were counted as if they would be 3,000. So what do we see from here? That the mundane stealing of an ox, civil law, has tremendous spiritual implications in areas that have nothing to do with rationale and nothing to do with between man and man. Yes?
But that's only if you slaughter or sell it.
Right, but here basically they sold it, meaning they put it out of the rishus that it was in, and they put it into their rishus, just like selling it. Okay, in any case, so that's a case where something that seems to be a very simple civil law has implications both for character building and for the most esoteric kind of spiritual forces in the world. Another example. Torah says like this. If you loan somebody money and you take a guarantee, a collateral, and you take, the guy doesn't have too much, so you take his bed as collateral, his mattress. So the halacha is that you can keep it in the daytime, you have to return it at night. Okay, let the guy sleep on his mattress. So anything that he uses during the day, you give back during the day and you take it again at night. And something he uses at night, you take back, you give back at night and take it back in the daytime. That's halacha of collateral. Okay. I loan this guy money. I'm not allowed to take interest from him. It's interest-free loan. I can't pressure him if he can't pay me back. Right? I can't, if I know that he doesn't have the money, I can't put pressure on him. Right? I have to be patient. So, I'm such a nice guy. right? I loaned you the money. I didn't take any interest. All I did was take collateral, right? Your mattress. And now I'm getting the feeling that you're not going to pay me back, that you're going to abscond and run away. So I want at least to have something in my hand that I don't lose the whole amount that I lent you. So I take your mattress as collateral. Now comes sunset, and I'm supposed to return it to you. But I'm afraid that you're going to run away overnight with the mattress. So I don't give it back like I'm supposed to, and I hold on to it overnight. And you have to sleep on the floor or on a less comfortable mattress or whatever. And in the morning, you, in your Shmoneh Esrei, in Elokai Nitzor, add the following. You say, God, what's it called? That Russia, what's it called? Guy who lent me the money, right? He took my mattress and he didn't give it back. God, give him what he deserves. Now, if you were God, how would you react to that prayer? I'll tell you how I would react. Why, you ungrateful thing. This guy loaned you money, interest-free, right? He's not pressuring you. He only wants some collateral in his hand that you can't abscond and make him lose his entire debt, right? That's owed to him. And one day he didn't give you back your mattress and you called to me to punish him. This guy did you so many favors. So one day he didn't give you back your mattress, right? How about the fact that he loaned you the money to begin with? How about the fact that, what's it called, that he didn't take any interest from you? He didn't put any pressure on you. Well, chutzpah. If I was God, I'd zap that guy with a lightning bolt, right? You are an ungrateful thing. What does God say? V'shamati, I'll listen to his prayer, ki chanun ani, because I'm a gracious God. So, the obvious question is, I mean, God's very gracious, but how about being gracious to the guy who made the loan? The guy who gave the loan? Right? He doesn't deserve some brownie points for it? I mean, some what's it called? To be gracious to him? Only to the poor guy who's so ungrateful? So I think the Rashbam says what I'm telling you. If he doesn't, I think it's a nice pshat anyway. But I think that's what the meaning of the Rashbam. Really, if you look at things between man and man rationally, that guy had no right to say that prayer. He's ungrateful, and God shouldn't listen to him, if anything. But we have a mitzvah of emulating God. Mahu rachum afatote rachum. We have a mitzvah of emulating God's character traits. And he's called merciful, so we should be merciful. He's called gracious. Gracious means you give even if the person doesn't deserve. And we also have to be gracious. Memela, Enochinami, this guy does not deserve that I should return the mattress. But I'm supposed to emulate God and be gracious like he is. And I didn't, because I had my own cheshbonos, my own best interest in mind, not giving back the mattress, instead of being a gracious person and saying, you know what, I'll take the risk, let him have his mattress back, even though he doesn't deserve it. I deserve to hold on to it because I'm not sure if he's going to be around tomorrow to pay me back the debt, or he's going to run away with his mattress. I'm going to hold on to the mattress because I have something in my hand to make up what I gave him. So, the reason why God will listen to that lender's loan, the one who loaned the money, borrowed the money, the borrower's prayer, is not because between man and man it's warranted, but because since the lender should have fulfilled the mitzvah bein adam lamakom, between man and God, of emulating God's midos, and one of them is to be chanun, to be gracious. And he wasn't gracious, that's why I listened to the prayer. Not because the person who's praying deserves I answer his prayer. He's ungrateful. But there's another thing between man and God, that we're supposed to emulate God. And in that respect, I was deficient, that's why God listened to his prayer. So it comes out that there's a mixture, it's a chalant. It's not purely between man and man. It's not purely between man and God. Everything between man and man has an aspect between man and God, and everything of man and God has an aspect between man and man. I'll give you the example of the man and God, which has an aspect of man and man. Torah says, if you have an animal that's treif, we use the word treif in a very universal way, but it's not. It's a specific thing. Treifa means an animal that was kosher animal that was mauled by a wild animal and it injected its venom or it made a hole in the heart or the brain, one of 18 different kinds of maladies. So the animal now is not going to be able to survive. It's going to die within a year because of the wound that was inflicted by this wild animal. So even if I shecht the animal, it's called a trefa. I shechted it, but it was an animal with a disease, right, specific disease. The shechita doesn't help, and the animal's still not kosher. That's called a trefa. On the other hand, an animal that died, that wasn't shechted, or I beat its brains in, shot it in the head, what's it called, and that killed it like that, didn't kill it with shechita, that's called a nevela. It's a kosher animal, but it died another way than shechita. A trefa you shecht, it's still prohibited. A nevela is an animal you didn't shecht. That's called nevela. So the Torah says, if you have these animals, you have a sheep that's a nevela and a sheep that's a trefa. One was attacked by a wild animal, it had a disease, and you shechted it, and it's not kosher, because you found out that its lungs had a hole in it, or its brain had a hole in it, or whatever. And the other one died of old age, or what's it called, or you shot it, or whatever. So it's a nevela. So the Torah says like this, the nevela, either give it to a ger toshav, a non-Jew who keeps seven mitzvahs, give it to him for free, because we have a mitzvah to support them. So find the ger toshav who's poor, give him that nevela, because you can't eat it, you might as well give it to him. Or sell it to an Oved Avodah Zarah, to an idol worshiper. Can't give free presents to an idol worshiper, you're supporting their idol worship. You can sell it to him. Sell it to an Oved Avodah Zarah. So the Torah's advice of what to do with an animal that's a nevela, give it to a goy. What's the advice, what to do with an animal that's a trefa? Lakelef tashlichim also, throw it to the dogs. So why the trefa we throw to the dogs, and the nevela we give to a human being? So Medrash says that the dogs get a reward, special reward, because they didn't bark in Mitzrayim. So, at Makas Bechoros, since they didn't bark, right, they got a reward that they get the trefas. But it doesn't answer why they don't get the nevelas. Why dafka the trefa? Okay. So the Dasakenim Mibalei HaTosfos, the Ibn Ezra, this is Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says a very logical reason why. He says that the trefa is spiritually, something's wrong with it spiritually. It's opposite. The nevela is only something spiritual wrong with it. The nevela is not physically anything wrong with it. It died. It was shot with a gun. You killed it. There's nothing wrong with it spiritually. There's only something wrong with it physically. There's only something wrong with it spiritually. But the treif is sick. So it's physically something wrong with it. Don't give the treifa to a non-Jew because he's a human being. It's going to give him a stomachache. But give it to the dog. Dog can handle it. But the nevela is only spiritually problematic. It's not spiritually problematic for a goy. Give it to him. That's the idea. So here we have a purely kosher law, and yet we're dealing with goyim and yidden, right? Goyim and animals or whatever, not to give a goy a stomachache. Torah mixes in your interpersonal relationship with goyim in this kashrus law. In addition, there's another law we learn from this. The Das Akenu Mibalei HaTosfos says that there's another reason we give it to the dog. Right? Why when a trefa you give to the dog? Because every flock of sheep usually had a sheepdog that helped the shepherd to protect the sheep. The dog stand guard, barked, right, chased away predators. So this dog served you as what's it called, as a faithful dog in serving the flock. Now you have an animal from that flock that you can't eat because it's treif. So reward the dog for his good work for the flock. There's only one problem, says the Das Akenu Mibalei HaTosfos. You know why you have an animal you can't eat? Because the dog didn't do his job. Had the dog been successful in doing his job, then this animal would not have been mauled by a wild animal. Obviously, the dog was derelict. So what are you going to do now? Reward the dog for not doing his job? He says, yeah. Because 99% of the time he did his job. And he saved you from having these problems. So one time he wasn't successful. Because the one time he's not successful, you should punish him for all the times he was successful. Give him the meat. So, very nice. That's a very nice idea. It has to do with kashrus, you know, with treifas or whatever. The Torah happens to say, throw it to the dog. But listen to the lesson we learn from that. How, sometimes you have a friend who you've done favors for, he's done favors for you, he's been your loyal friend for years. And then the friend does you dirty. Something he does, really, not nice. How do we normally react to a person like that? We write him off from our book. I don't want to speak to the guy again. I'm annoyed for him. It erases every good thing that he did for me in the past is erased, and this, all I remember is the last thing. You don't treat a dog like that, according to the Torah. That's how you treat a human being. So we can learn from the kashrus laws, which are spiritual, religious laws, laws of what's it called, of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. Because the Torah says, send it to the dog, right? Because don't let his dereliction, his failure this time erase all the good times. Yeah.
We don't say that for sure by a husband who for thousands of days was faithful and then one day, just one day.
No, sometimes, no, it depends. Sometimes the lapse is so serious that you can't go on. That doesn't mean that you still shouldn't recognize the good, right? It could be they have to get divorced. You can't trust this person anymore, right? He's unfaithful. But that doesn't mean that you have to have a mean, what's it called, adversary kind of divorce. Lemaisa, till this point, he was a good husband. You benefited from him. So at least show a certain amount of gratitude for that in how the divorce is. Maybe it won't make a difference whether you divorce him or not. But at least, what's it called? Do it in a nice way because you own that. Don't erase all the good because of something bad. That's the idea. One more short thing. Let's see which one. The Meshech Chochma. One place it says, Vayanu kol ha'om yachtov, nas kol asher dibra Hashem nasa. Everything God said we will do. And there it says that all the people answered together. And then another place it says, Vayanu kol ha'am. It doesn't say yachtov together. It says all the people answered, kol asher dibra Hashem nasa v'nishma. There it says, we'll do and we'll listen, we'll learn. So the Meshech Chochma asks, why in one place does it just say nasa, we'll do? And in that place it has the word yachtov, they all answered together. And in the other place it leaves out that they answered together, but it says nasa v'nishma. He says like this. He said, the truth is that there's no one individual who could ever do all 613 mitzvahs. Because some mitzvahs are only for Kohanim, and some are only for Leviim, and some are only for Yisraelim. So if you're a Kohen, you don't have the mitzvahs of Yisrael. And if you're Yisrael, you don't have the mitzvahs of a Kohen. If you're a man, you don't have the mitzvahs of a woman. And if you're a woman, you don't have the mitzvahs of a man. There's some mitzvahs that no woman could ever do. Bris Milah. But there are certain mitzvahs that no man would ever do. They sacrifice after childbirth. At least in my lifetime, I'm hoping no man ever fulfills that mitzvah. Right? That's a woman's mitzvah. She has babies and she brings that korban. So, unless you're a Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, man and woman wrapped into one, which today may be possible, but under normal circumstances was not, you can't have 613 mitzvahs. So what's this idea that we said everything that God said we'll do? How can you do everything? Nobody can do everything. It's impossible. Because the mitzvahs don't apply equally to everybody. So the Meshech Chochma says, that's what the Torah says. How could we do everything? One of two ways. If we answer together, united, then we're one unit. And what you do helps for me, what I do helps for you. So together as a unit, we have 613 mitzvahs. So vayanu kol ha'om yachtov, when the people answered in unity, then they said everything that God said we can actually do. Because I don't have to do it personally. We're all one unified group. And therefore, what you do helps for me, what I do helps for you, and all together, we're doing everything. Then there's another way. that you can fulfill all the mitzvahs, even though some mitzvahs don't apply to you. The mitzvahs that you can't do physically, you can learn about. And learning about a mitzvah that you can't do is if you did it. So when it doesn't say yachtov, if we're all united, then we actually can all do the mitzvahs, because what you do helps for me, what I do helps for you. But if we're not all united, we just answer together, all of us answer, but not together, then the only way we can all fulfill all 613 mitzvahs is nasa v'nishma. We'll do what we can, and we'll learn about the things that we can't do, and as if you did it. So when they're all together, they actually can do the mitzvahs by everybody contributing their unique part. When they're not all together, they can only do the mitzvahs by learning about the ones that don't apply to them. So when it says yachtov, it says nasa. When it doesn't say yachtov, it says nasa v'nishma, in order they should be able to do everything that God said, one of those two ways.